Friends, good morning. This morning we will be exploring together Sufi practices of zikr, divine remembrance. Zikr means to remember. But it means something more than to remember what has happened in the past. It is to remember what happens in the present. That is the meaning of presence. So we are recollecting a causal chain that is not temporal. We are not retracing our being through time, but rather ontological, retracing our being to its essence in the moment, rediscovering what is most primal and basic in our experience. This morning we will be practicing two forms of zikr, one internal and the other external. And both are forms that have been passed down over the centuries from heart to heart. They're not contained in books. They are a transmission of the breath. And the essential feature of the practice of zikr is the awakening of presence in the breath. In the silent zikr, it is awakening the silent breath. In the vocal zikr, it is awakening the breath through sound. But in both cases, what is essential is the breath. That mysterious field of being that is invisible and so often forgotten, and yet which is the principle of unity within which we all interact and from which we draw our sustenance from the cosmos, and in return enrich the cosmos with the trace of our own contribution to the unfoldment of being. That is the constant interplay of breath that continues moment by moment, whether we are conscious or not. And the opportunity, the privilege that is offered to us is to make this cycle of being that connects the ephemeral and the eternal, the inner and the outer, to make this cycle of being conscious. The murshid of my grandfather, Hazrat Pir Murshid Inayat Khan, said, on this path, there is only one sin and only one virtue. The sin is the breath that is breathed in forgetfulness, and the virtue is the breath that is breathed in consciousness of the unity of being. That is the purpose of our zikr. Zikr is a practice that grows within us. This morning we will have an opportunity to be introduced to the form, but zikr is something that you live with and it grows in you. It cannot be grasped, but it can be grown. The Sufis sometimes say there are four stages of zikr. The first is when you participate in a ritual of zikr in a circle. And with your body, you are following the movements. And with your tongue, you are making the correct recitations. But your mind is elsewhere. And then there's a second stage if you persevere. Your body is in rhythm, you're chanting, and your mind becomes increasingly absorbed in the rhythmic experience and becomes more focused. But still, stray thoughts arise, one becomes distracted, and one brings oneself back again and again to the zikr. And then there is a third stage, when one is perfectly attuned. The body is in rhythm, the tongue is reciting, the mind is stilled, the heart is awakened. It is a single, seamless experience. And you might think that must be the perfection of the zikr. But there is a fourth stage, and that is when the ritual is finished. You're no longer, you're moving your body rhythmically, your tongue is not reciting, you return to the routines of your life, in the office, or driving on the road. And still, your heart continues the zikr. That is the perpetual zikr. When you are no longer saying the zikr, but the zikr is saying you. This grows with the intensity of sincerity. The first practice, as I say, that we will work with involves stimulating the subtle centers, called in Sufism the lataif, the subtleties embedded within the physical body, of which, according to the system of the Sufis, there are seven primary ones. And each of these subtle centers corresponds to one of the levels of being that span the spectrum from the outermost, the dense hard core of manifestation, all the way back to the most sublime, abstract, eternal, transcendent dimension of being. There's a spectrum of experience. And there is, within the body of each of us, an organ of spiritual perception that corresponds to each of these planes of existence. And in a 24-hour period, all of us experience each of the planes of being. In the depths of deep sleep, we experience the highest stages of samadhi. The difference is that in zikr, one makes these experiences conscious and integrated within a whole view of life. no longer fragmentary experiences. The body is a microcosm containing all that exists within the whole. The five elements are here, the mineral, vegetable, and animal kingdoms are here. The stars in the galaxies are right here in the body, but dormant, awaiting our consciousness, awaiting the presence that will awaken what exists within us. In each part of us is a part of the cosmos. And there is one place in which all parts of the cosmos are mingled together in us. The place of utmost concentration. That is the heart, the center of the human being. And so the heart is at the center of the spiritual anatomy that forms the lata'if. The lata'if form a cross. And indeed, the cross is the expression of the truth of the human being. It is not merely a religious symbol. It is also a spiritual symbol, a symbol of our inner body. So I want to first provide you with some of the theory that underpins our practice, while recognizing that the moment will come when this theory must be dispensed with, so that one can be fully awake to the sheer moment of what one is experiencing. The theory provides a template within which to orient oneself within this universe which we are newly discovering. The first of the lata'if is called the qalab. That means the mold. And it has its place at the base of the spine, corresponding to the Muladhara chakra in Hatha Yoga. It corresponds to the plane of Nasut, the plane of manifestation, the physical realm. And we may think that we know this physical realm quite well, and that what it is that we seek is something more abstract. But if one pauses and reflects, one may find that the simple experience of embodiment, the sensation of the soles of your feet on the ground, the vividness of the air that you breathe, these are all physical sensations, very concrete, and yet so often, sadly, beyond the pale of our awareness. This physical body is not as it appears. We think that it is our body that distinguishes us from other people and which provides our sense of individual identity. But it is not the body itself, but our image of the body, which science is increasingly showing to be ridiculously flawed, or at least highly subjective. We think of ourselves as a monolith, separate, static. We are this body that we inhabit. Whereas in truth, this body is constantly perishing, dying, worn away. Cells shed like the skin of a snake. New cells divided and born as we draw sustenance from the environment. Indeed, in the space of 5 years, our entire physical body has been recycled. We are in constant flux. And so rather than a unit, an object, it would be better to think of oneself as a vortex within an ecology of life, assimilating the fabric of the cosmos and scattering as we grow and develop that which is no longer able to be assimilated. And within this body, there is a subtle template that is the life field, whereupon the physical structure is constructed from the elements of the environment. For example, it has been shown that reptiles are able to regrow their tail, on the basis of the field of electromagnetism that surrounds the body, and if that field is enhanced by an electric charge, the regrowth can be enhanced. So there are fields within our anatomy that are only gradually coming into the knowledge of biologists and have been recognized for centuries by the mystics as the subtle body, the qalb, the mold of this physical body. The Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, said that when we die and are buried, this subtle body will be absorbed into the base of the spine and will reside in dormancy for some time and then will regrow from that seed as our body of resurrection. And the Sufis say, "Mutu qabla an tamutu." Die before you die. Fashion the body of resurrection here and now. This physical body is malleable only up to a point, whereas the mold which underpins it is still more responsive to changes in our consciousness. And through it, these changes register in our physical body. You will find that those who practice spiritual disciplines and maintain high ethics in life, their very countenance, very expression begins to more and more reflect those values, those practices. The physical body itself is reconfigured, and that is through the qalb, the subtle mold, which we perhaps felt yesterday when we attuned to the breath and then to the heartbeat, and feeling how when one follows the heartbeat into the extremities, into the hands and into the head, one realizes that there is no clear boundary. It reverberates outside of the body within the greater field of life. That is the form of the mold. not so clearly contoured. So it is here that we first work bringing awakening and presence, because when this subtle body has become clogged with the pollution of unawareness, which is experienced by the mystic as a palpable dark substance, a cloudy, viscous substance, when this is confronted with the light of awareness and with the reverberation of the divine name, there is a clarification that can take place, and the subtle body is no longer an obstacle between the outer and the inner, but can become a medium for the flow of energy between the poles of our being. And then we come to the second latifa, which has its place in the abdomen, just two finger widths beneath the navel, the pit of the belly, the nafs center. And here we discover our psychosomatic condition, our body-mind complex, as it generates the ego. Our gut feeling. And this is a structure, a subtle structure, that grows with our maturation. In its most primitive state, it is merely reactive, following the instinct of flight or fight. But as it evolves, it recognizes itself in another. That is the principle of higher ethics. One is incapable of self-sacrifice. Self-sacrifice is an oxymoron. You can only ever act in your own best interest. There is no alternative to that. But you can discover yourself in another. There is no boundary to the expansion of one's sense of identity. And so, as the nafs develops, it more and more realizes the limitations of a bounded sense of identity. As we're discovering at the geopolitical level today, seeing the limitations of unilateralism, and that ultimately security and prosperity depend upon a collective, global vision. And so it is with the nafs as it evolves from the first stage of nafs al-amara, that is demanding and imperative, and insisting on its prerogatives, to a further stage called nafs al-lawama, which looks not outwardly to cast blame, but inwardly to consider its own responsibility, reflect upon its own shortcomings, and make amends, and work creatively with the environment rather than reactively. And of course, biologists recognize that the study of the history of life on Earth shows that those species that have contributed positively to their environment are the ones that have been the longest surviving. And those that have despoiled the ecology of being perished quickly. So it is a more enlightened view of self-interest. And then a further stage, nafs al-mutmainna, when the nafs is no longer blaming itself, no longer blaming another, nor even blaming itself, but has reached a state of acceptance, of tranquil abiding. And that is what is called mutmainna. And with this unfoldment, a structural change occurs in the physical body, in the abdominal space. A vastness opens, and the abdomen is rediscovered as the true center of gravity in the physical body, as is experienced by martial artists and equestrians. And in this way, the energy that rises up from the earth through the feet and the legs can meet with the energy that descends through the crown, the celestial energy that is descending. When there is blockage, there is dislocation, disunity. And then we come to a still profounder level of our being, and that is the physical heart, the subtle dimension of the physical heart, qalb, in the left breast. The heart is the depth of the mind, and the mind is the surface of the heart. The heart is the unconscious realm, which speaks in symbols, which appears to us in our dreams, in our visions, which is articulated not in prose but in poetry. The story of the heart is not our biography, rather it is our sacred history, it is the myth of our life. It is the story of the archetypal images that have unfolded in the course of our experience. Our experience is distilled in the heart in the manner of a perfume. Incidental facts drop away, and what remains is something rich with meaning. And here we come to another axis. There is the vertical axis, and there is a horizontal axis. And these two axes meet at the center. The vertical axis is the basis for ascension toward transcendent consciousness. The vertical axis is the basis for outreach, expansion, outward, inclusion, sympathetic resonance with all beings. And opposite the physical heart, in the right breast, along this horizontal axis, is the ruh, spirit. Still more subtle than the heart. It is through the heart that the spirit speaks to the ego. It is through the heart that bodies are spiritualized and spirits are corporealized, that the sensible and the intelligible converge. At the level of spirit, one ascends still further beyond the sensible, toward the intelligible, a state of subtle perceptions, the perceptions of one's angelic witness, the witness in the heavens that exists within each of us, however occluded it may be, veiled by our assumptions, by our conditioning. It remains within us. However soiled we may sometimes feel, as though we have fallen irredeemably from the state of grace, and the gates of heaven are locked to us. It is there. It is only our identification with our own limitation that prevents its recovery. But if we look into the eyes of a newborn child and can discover there something that reminds us of home, state of wonderment, of purity, if we can see it in a child, it is only because of this that it exists in us. This is so clearly articulated by Plato when he says there is nothing that can be learned. One can only recognize that which one already knows. And if you see it in another, if you can recognize the holiness in the image of an angel, a great spiritual being, or a newborn child, the reason is precisely this. You see it because it is you. And so at this level of the work, one rediscovers the state of the angel who is perpetually invoking the divine name, glorifying the divine presence, like moths around a candle, circumambulating the divine throne, swimming on waves of exaltation and primordial love. And then we come to the sir in the center of the breast, the secret center. Our primary, let's say our commonest mode of knowledge is what the illuminationists call knowledge by correspondence. And what that means is that an object exists outside of ourselves, we perceive it with the senses, and we construct in our mind an image that corresponds to the outer object. And so we know the object through the image of the object that exists in our mind. That is conceptual knowledge, knowledge by correspondence. And yet, how do we know the image in our minds? Do we make another image, another concept, and so on, ad infinitum? It would never end. For knowledge to exist, there must be a moment of immediacy. No medium, no intermediary. A direct act of presence in which knower and known converge as a unity of experience. And so, although we know ourselves by virtue of our self-image, of course our self-image no doubt differs very much from the image that other people have of ourselves. It's just one more image among many images that that are attributed to us. And yet we also know ourselves in a way that someone else does not know ourselves. We know ourselves through the immediacy of presence. So that is an alternate mode of knowing the more basic, the most essential mode of knowing. Knowledge by presence, which is the very nature of the soul itself. The soul is nothing. The soul has no definition, no meaning, other than this, the simple, perpetual act of self-knowing. The soul is its own awareness. And so at this level of our being, the sir, consciousness, which implies subject and object, consciousness is resorbed into its ground as pure intelligence, consciousness without object, sheer luminous self-presence. That is the plane of Jabarut. And then we come to the next Latifa in the third eye center. Khafi, the arcanum. And here we have moved far beyond our individuated existence. We have returned to the origins of manifestation, to the primal moment following the impulse upwelling in the solitude of eternity, the impulse of longing. I was a hidden treasure, and I longed to be known, so I created the world that I might be known. The sigh of compassion. There is a moment in which eternity implodes in a movement of love, a movement toward actualization, toward manifestation and fulfillment, expression, evolution toward that which cannot yet be preconceived, prefigured. Anticipation of the unexpected from the very innermost void of eternity. But the manifestation occurred not randomly, not without order or meaning, but according to channels of the creative energy corresponding to the essential inner nature of reality itself, called by the Sufis the ayanathabda, the eternal archetypes. These are the wellsprings of all of the qualities, all of the emotions, all of the colors, all of the features that we experience in such diverse forms. All of this manifestation has its sources in these pure channels of the manifestation of the divine creativity. And so at this level of our being, we rediscover the seedbed of our personality. The qualities that exist in us in a limited and often distorted form, we discover here in their transcendent dimension, a dimension which nonetheless requires the particulars particularization of those very qualities. The divine names. And then ascending right up to the top, the crown center. Come to Ahva, the transcendent pole of our being, where words fail utterly. I often refer to words of that great poet, Percy Bysshe Shelley, who said, "The winged words on which my soul would pierce the height of love's rare universe are chains of lead around its flight of fire. I pant, I sink, I tremble, I expire." And of course, if a poet of the caliber of Shelley felt this way, what can any of us say about these dimensions of being? We have no words. It is simply this, the state of perfect unity, changeless, eternal, perfect, where you are now as you ever were and always will be. So, this has been a an example of theory, but what is essential in Sufism is not the concept but the experience. This is all scaffolding for our practice. So we are going to have an opportunity to turn within and practice the zikr of the broom, zikr-e jarub, which means that we are sweeping each of these organs within the body that corresponds to the planes that I tried to describe, sweeping out all that is collected there that prevents the flow of energy up and down. And in our sweeping, we use two sacred names, which are in Sufism the essential names. Allah, who. Allah is a name that is very well known, certainly in the media today. But we have to be prepared to overcome what we think we know about Allah in order to experience something real. The way that Allah has been defined both in Islamic discourse and outside of Islamic discourse will not serve our purposes. But we can look for an indication in the words of a great Sufi sheikh, Hazrat Najmuddin Kubra, who said, he traced the etymology of Allah, and he said, Allah, spelled A-L-L-A-H, the first part, the essential part is the H. And H is the letter in the alphabet that corresponds to the sound of the breath. Of course, all of the sounds that are formed by the letters of the alphabet are made with the breath. But the breath is conditioned through the use of the throat, the tongue, the teeth, the lips, whereas H is the purest, simplest form of the sounding of the breath. So it represents the original breath before its articulation in forms, in its pure form. And preceding the H comes Al, A-L-L. And in Arabic you may know that Al means the. And if the L is doubled, it is intensified. So putting all of this together, what it means is that Allah is the only breath, the universal breath, the breath of all breaths, the source of that great sigh of compassion. And who begins with the H and ends with what is called in Arabic the waw, the U sound. So if the H is the sound that the breath makes before it reaches the accommodation of the mouth, what is the last sound that would be made by the breath as it leaves the mouth? Would be made with the lips. Ooh, ooh, ooh. So who combines the first and the last? The breath as it rises up from the lungs, and the breath just as it, the moment it escapes the lips. Alpha and Omega. And so while Allah, the divine name Allah, refers to the divine in the state of eternity, in the state of transcendent perfection, who refers to the divine in the state of actualization, open-ended manifestation, moving inexorably toward the constantly receding horizon of the evolution of consciousness. So these are our two most sacred names, Allah and Hu. And it is with these names that we sweep out each of the subtle centers in sequence. So, with this background, we will begin our meditation. Let me say, just before you stretch, this is a practice which I offer for our shared experience here. And after this, we will do a zikr, also collectively, vocally. These are sacred practices of the Sufi tradition, which, as I say, are passed from heart to heart. And if one feels the calling to make this a practice within one's own regimen of ongoing work, then it must be done with the guidance of an instructor who knows this way, who has followed this path, knows its stations, and who can guide you. Because the spiritual path is a most serious undertaking with the most significant of consequences. Consequences which can result in the progressive fulfillment of one's purpose in incarnation, but which can also result if one plays with powers beyond the scope of one's expertise, can result in great confusion and even disorientation and other negative consequences. I offer to you here what is safe and possible for me to offer. And I want to simply say, as a caution to you, that whichever path you choose, and perhaps some of you or many of you are already following a particular spiritual path, whatever path you choose, let it be one with integrity and with availing yourself of all possible guidance on the way, as it has been my privilege to receive in my own life, and which has been for me the source of blessing and protection. So, if you will now, take a brief moment just to stretch in silence, and then take your place again.